Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new episode of Esports Boom, your weekly esports business wrap-up podcast, and very excited for this week's guest. I mean, over the past few weeks, we've had investors in the space, we've had, you know, people from the sponsorship side, people from the team side, and I looked around and looked, what aspects of the industry haven't we yet touched on? And I realized that there's a whole, obviously there's a very, very big part we haven't touched, and it's like, the actual esports side, right? The actual people in front of the camera, not just the people behind the camera doing all the business. So extremely excited to have Julia Alexandria on this week, who is a TV host, a TV personality, a sideline reporter, both in traditional sports. But she's also an esports OG, having worked with MLG in the Halo days. And just very excited to have you on, Julie. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. Esports OG. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, in an industry without a lot of OGs, like, I'm just very grateful to talk to whoever I can talk about in the early days, because esports is a bit older than 1 year. So 90% of the world doesn't realize that. So your history is fascinating, and as our listeners are used to, we'll go in depth about your history and about your work in the industry the second half of the podcast. But as always, like we the first half of the podcast, we go over our weekly kind of the business stories. So a lot has happened. Actually, the first story we're touching on actually happened last week. But the problem with recording the podcast, and we're recording this on a Thursday afternoon, is that sometimes stuff that's really big happens afterwards, and you just have to wait a week. So Drake and Ninja, they broke the Twitch world record, like one channel personal record, not a tournament record, while playing Fortnite. So there were over 600,000 people at their peak, which smashed the previous record of 388,000 set by the PUBG streamer Dr. Disrespect. NFL player Juju Smith-Schuster, who's a known gamer and affiliated with FaZe Clan, the esports team, and hip-hop artist Travis Scott joined as well. So this was really, really interesting. So Julie, like, known obviously as a personality that has been on Twitch broadcast and has worked both in traditional entertainment and esports. How do moments, like, what are your thoughts on this? And how do moments like this kind of make conversations for you a lot easier?
Well, first off, let's be clear. They did not just break a Twitch record. They basically broke the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a while, it was the number one trending topic on Twitter worldwide. And that's pretty fantastic. And you talk about OGs. I mean, Tyler Ninja, he yes. is an OG. I remember
from Halo, right?
From the Halo yeah. days. I remember covering him as a competitor in Halo. I believe it was Halo Reach at that point. We were done with Halo 3. So we're going all the way back, let's call it 2010, 2011. And here's Tyler, and he's just killing it in Halo. And then to watch his career to what it is now, and then you've got a mainstream pop culture icon, you've got Drake, and he's keying into Fortnite. When you talk about Fortnite, I mean, I think that this is really the gateway game. This is going to be the one that binds. This is going to be the connective tissue between pop culture, mainstream sort of gaming culture, mainstream sports, and into esports. And you've even got outlets like Barstool Sports, SportsCenter. They're talking about Fortnite. So yeah. Never before have we seen, I mean, even with the boom of Overwatch League, Barstool Sports didn't pick up Overwatch, but they're picking up Fortnite. And you've got people who play so many different games, but the one common denominator is Fortnite between pop culture, people, between gamers, casual gamers. And so I think we're really going to see an interesting emergence of sort of pop culture icons getting involved in esports and just sort of raising the visibility of esports.
Yeah, and I think this is really interesting because Ninja Tyler was on CNBC the other day, which was really cool because all of a sudden I get a lot of messages, not only from business clients, so people who are interested in this space, but also from like friends who are like, hey, like, is this video game stuff you're working on? And it's a lot easier because as much crossover there is, especially in gaming in general, not just esports, the easier conversations become for all of us. And so looking at kind of an esports talent moving into a different kind of role, do you see, and this is more of a general question, and I know we usually save those for the second half, but do you see that artists or esports players are going to move towards these type of roles more often? And what are some advice that you can give to them? How can they make that transition as smoothly as possible?
I think they will be making the transition. I think we are going to see more esports players come into the more mainstream, if you will, connecting with other athletes in other major league sports, mainstream sports, and other visible personalities. And I think it's going to be through branding. I think it's going to be through the advertisers. I think you're going to see sponsorships. I mean, even to go back to 2 years ago, 2016, I was working for the Padres in San Diego, mm-hmm. the baseball team. And Tyler Ninja actually came down, and one day I come down to the dugout and he's sitting there playing with on console with a couple of the pitchers.
No way.
And he was there. And this was all part of an initiative with Bud Light. And this was
an all-star.
He was an all-star. This was through Bud Light All-Stars. And I come down and he's wearing a Padres baseball jersey with Ninja on the back. And I thought, this is the beginning of something really interesting. We're going to start seeing major league esports athletes, competitors, mm-hmm. sort of blending the line into mainstream sports, and they're going to be more visible. I mean, I think it's really only a matter of time until we're watching a Super Bowl commercial and you've got someone like a Ninja, or you've got some other esports competitor that's got a pretty high profile, and he's going to be drinking Dr. Pepper, or he's going to be drinking a Coke on the ad. So I really think it's going to come down to branding and the business development in esports and sponsorships.
This year, during the Super Bowl commercial, we saw Ricegum, who was a famous YouTuber. So that was, he was in one of the commercials. So that's already, you know, shows what's coming. Really interesting that you mentioned Bud Light, because Tyler Ninja is known to have the Bud Light. Whenever he streams, he has his Bud Light fridge in the background. And I know the guys behind the Bud Light All-Star really well, and they, the agency was like, when this news broke out, they were so happy, because they're like, we're creating value for our clients, like tremendous value for our clients, even when they're not paying us right away, right? So like, they were really, really excited. One of the things you mentioned, you know, esports players like moving into mainstream culture, I actually think that this will continuing trend that also works the other way around. So not only does this justify mainstream gaming culture and esports culture to the mainstream, I think we'll see a lot more kind of traditional sports athletes and entertainers looking to kind of Twitch and video game streaming as another way to reach a different audience. That's one thing I have been pushing for years. Whenever I talk with traditional sports teams, I'm saying, you have a baseball player that loves video games, why not stream? Some great examples of people who are doing that right now is you have Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson, the UFC fighter, who is killing it on Twitch.
Who, by the way, was an Xbox ambassador with Uriah Faber. And I covered both of them in Vegas for their fights, because I was the host and I covered E3 for Xbox for a very mm-hmm. long time. And the two of them have been in the game for a very long time. And it's true. I absolutely agree with you. I think we are going to see a lot more crossover the other way, because as someone who has basically, cut my teeth on being in clubhouses, on being in locker rooms, you've got a few hours before game time. And what are these guys doing? They're playing video games.
Well, they're doing nothing 50% of their day anyways, because they're going to practice, and then afterwards they're not doing anything.
Right. We're on the road a lot. I mean, I've traveled mm-hmm. with professional teams for a very long time, for most of my career, and they're very limited in what they can do physically and also how they spend their time. And you're right, when you're only really working, quote unquote, in the public eye, meaning during game time, for about 2.5 to 3 hours, maybe four if you're a baseball player, there is so much downtime, and you can't always get to a golf course. You can't always you know, run or do something physical, but you can certainly pick up a console and start gaming. And then, of course, the online relationships start between the gamers and the professional athletes. And also, you've got professional athletes with expendable income who want to invest. Yeah. And so you're seeing a lot of these athletes getting in and getting their piece of the esports pie.
Yeah, actually, I think in traditional sports players were some of the earliest kind of investors in the esports space. We're looking in the last few years. Renegades is owned by Jonas Chipenko. I'm butchering his name. Shaq has some investment in NRG, etc., etc. And yeah, and I think athletes have a great role for this. And I hate plugging, but I was interviewed for a Portada Online article the other day, written by our mutual friend Joe Favorito. There was an Argentinian soccer player who invested in an esports company, and I talked a little bit about the role of the athlete. I'll put that link all the way in the bottom in the description box after all of your links as well. But let's move on to our second story. So kind of a more into kind of a financial direction general. So Ubisoft reached an agreement with Vivendi for its full exit from Ubisoft's share capital. So just to make it, you know, very simple, so Vivendi sold their entire 27.3% stake in Ubisoft. Ubisoft is this gigantic French game publisher. And obviously this is all interesting, but I want to focus on one particular thing. So Tencent, the Chinese company, is now a 5% shareholder in Ubisoft and is forming a strategic partnership with them for the Chinese market. So just to talk a little bit about the ramifications of this. So number one, if people are not familiar, Tencent owns pretty much the gaming industry. Yeah, Julie, you're going with your hand like everything. So they own Riot Games 100%. They own, I think, a 25% stake in Activision Blizzard. They own a similar stake in Epic Games, which is the game publisher of Fortnite, the game we just talked about. And now they have a partnership with, or a 5% stake in Ubisoft. And while Ubisoft is a general game publisher, and they aren't that invested in esports, they are a publisher of Rainbow Six Siege, which is kind of an up-and-coming title that a lot of people are like, focus on this. This is a really good title. So now they're involved with it. So what I do think, as far as we focus just on Ubisoft, this can help them a lot to get into the Chinese market. So if you're a team and you're looking to kind of invest in a tier two title that has potential to move up the ranks a little bit, I would focus on Rainbow Six, because it already has a good viewer base. It's bubbling up slowly, but you can expect it to kind of explode in China over the next few years, similar to anything else with Tencent. So, Julie, obviously you know about Tencent's like kind of big expanse in the industry, and having worked with a lot of these publishers before as a host, do you have some thoughts on this? Like,
I mean, they're really becoming just sort of ubiquitous in the industry, and I think it's great. I mean, anytime you can connect two different publishers, two different companies, multi-companies. The only thing I'd be a little afraid of is that they would sort of start a monopoly and they would just become too big, but, with too much control, depending on how much, stake they have in the different companies. But at the end of the day, I really don't see a negative here.
Yeah, well, generally, Tencent is the kind of gatekeeper to the Chinese market. So a lot of times when a game gets popular, a publisher then wants to move into the biggest gaming market in the world, China, and they need distribution. And the biggest distribution platform is owned by Tencent. So a lot of times Tencent said, well, that's great. We'll buy a small part in your company. We'll overpay for it because we know the moment we bring you into China, your value shoots up the roof. So yeah, I do know what you're saying, how it's a little bit scary to see a publisher like that have so much control. So maybe for the general market perspective, it's a little awkward, but then for the publishers, obviously it's very positive if they actually get to work with Tencent. So focusing on this next story, so Arlington, Texas, The city announces a plan to build the largest esports stadium in the U.S. So Arlington, Texas, the city, has announced a plan for a 100,000 square foot state-of-the-art esports stadium that will open later this year. It will be the largest of its kind, and it will focus on attracting competitive players, fans, but also tourists from around the world. And the project is a collaboration between the city, architecture firm Populous, and esports venues, and Engage Esports. So people who are not familiar with Engage Esports is part of the Infinite Esports Entertainment arm, which is the current owner of Optic Gaming, which, Julie, obviously you are very familiar with from the MLG days. So obviously this is big, and it's cool to see a lot of local governments be more interested and put money down to attract the audiences. But what I'd like to hear from you, Julie, is coming from a background in both traditional sports and in esports, and having kind of worked through a lot of venues that are either traditional sports venues that are kind of converted quickly into esports venues, or venues that have nothing to do with traditional sports or esports that just have to be converted, like ballrooms or stuff like that, have to be converted into esports venues. What are some of the things you want to see in like an esports stadium? What are some of the things that would be helpful to you as a host?
Well, first of all, you're talking about Populous being involved. Mm-hmm. So let's start there. Populous knows what they're doing. If you look at their resume and the baseball parks alone that they've designed, you've got Angel Stadium, Busch Stadium, Citizens Bank Park, Coors Field. You've got Minute Maid Park, Progressive Field. I mean, it just goes on and on, not to mention the improvements that they've done on Wrigley, which are fantastic if you haven't been. So these guys know what they're doing, and they are going with a mainstream sports professional way. So I think that they're going about it the right way, mm-hmm. as getting the best in the business, or one of the biggest in the business, to sort of guide them on this construction. I have taken a tour of the esports arena in Burbank, mm-hmm. that is currently the old Johnny Carson studio at Burbank Studios, which has been taken over by Overwatch League, OWL.
The Blizzard Arena,
yeah. And I was really impressed. They've got, you know, all sort of the fixins, quote unquote, of any sort of arena. You've got a snack bar, you've got a gift shop, and then they have the stadium seating, and you've got the stage. Pretty basic. Mm-hmm. I think if they're looking to step it up a little bit, why not have smaller consoles and screens so that fans can go and kind of, you know, try their hand. Mm-hmm. Almost how when you go to a baseball park, if they have like a little, you know, T-ball set up for mm-hmm. kids to kind of play in the outfield. And I think they can step it. I mean, if they really want to go to the next level, I mean, get some really cool food pop-up, mm-hmm. you know, options there, yeah. and really make it, you know, a destination. I think that a lot of cities are kind of following in this. I think Dallas, you said, where it's going to be, I think that's a great place.
Well, MLG Dallas has been a staple for years.
Sure, yeah. Of course. And I think that, you know, along those lines, you look at the big sort of tourism attractive cities like Orlando and Dallas and LA or even San Diego. I mean, taking into account, you know, where people are going to be, this may be a destination for families when they're on vacation, just in line of like a Medieval Times or a Disneyland. It's something to do. It's an activity. Mm-hmm. But let's be real. Most people are consuming esports and all of the events and competitions online.
Yes.
So how many butts in seats are they going to fill? I don't know. I mean, I know they've got the esports arena in Vegas, but then also in Ohio, which Ohio has been
MLG
arena. And Ohio has been a hotbed for gamers forever. It's like Virginia for baseball players. It's weird. Something in the water. But I think it'll be interesting to see how much money they put into an event space. And let's be real, you know, an event space is only going to be as good as its events. So if they can land a world championship, if they can land a series, if they can land a competition, you know, schedule, then yeah, I think it'll be very successful. But what good is, you know, Cowboy Stadium without a Super Bowl every now and then, you know?
Well, it's good as Cowboy Stadium without a team playing there.
Exactly.
15 games a year or something like that. So I think that's the biggest issue with these type of stadiums, right? It's because, so the this week, or in a week, the Las Vegas Esports Arena, which is in the Luxor, will open, and they have a big tournament, and Tyler is going to actually be there as a guest, so probably going to fill up. But the problem is, if you're a soccer stadium, you have, you know, if you're Red Bull Arena here in New York, you know that every week, you know, every 2 weeks, it'll be filled up. Mm-hmm. And you know that you can build a reoccurring revenue source on that. And then you have tour, you have concerts that you can fill it up with. You have, friendly games and
right.
stuff like that.
They're going to have to become event spaces. Let's be real. I mean, there's just not enough gaming out there to keep the lights on 5 to 7 days a week. So if they are going to invest, I think they do need to look to promoters and to different companies that will place acts or, you know, even anything performance-wise that can go in there, and they need to make it convertible. So they need to make it, you know, something that can work both ways.
Yeah, and I can see an esports stadium getting like 4 or 5 big events a year, mm-hmm. but I can't see these stadiums getting more just because there aren't enough events, specifically with a lot of stadiums being built now or a lot of traditional sports stadiums that can host bigger events. So.
Right.
I'm optimistic, but cautiously, because I do, obviously would like to see more of their plans. So moving on to our last story, we'll go really quickly with that one, because then we'll go into the second half of our conversation. So Amazon's new game on API helps developers add esports competitions to their games. So they've built a new Amazon Web Service powered platform called Game On for third-party developers, which allows them to have things like tournaments, leaderboards, and leagues to their game. So basically giving them an opportunity to have like an online esports mode, so to say, without too much hassle. So the cool thing about it is that actually competition organizers and game developers and publishers can offer real-world prizes to players. So they might have a weekly tournament where you can win a gaming chair if you win it, or you can win something that's helpful for them, a reward prize. But obviously, it has to be a Amazon product. So I see you shaking your head. So
and Amazon wins again.
So we all know that Amazon takes gaming really seriously. They own Twitch.
Yeah.
So this is obviously further integration. So before I go too much into the depth, well, do you have any kind of surface thoughts on this?
I mean, it's not surprising. It's Amazon. They basically have their hands in everything. Although I will give them props because they are an early supporter of esports, and they're willing to put their money where the mouth is. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're absolutely willing to fund it and support it. So if they can get more eyeballs and if whatever it takes to, you know, up the profile, I'm all for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is typical Amazon. This is because this by itself is a great kind of business. It adds value to the consumer, but it also strengthens their core businesses, because you can see Twitch integration with this in the near future. You can see it further strengthens Amazon Web Services as a platform, but it also strengthens Amazon Prime, because they might have monthly Prime tournaments where they say in order to be part of this, you need to be a Prime member, and Amazon will pay for the prize. Like Amazon will pay $100 for the winner to get a prize. So this is really, really cool and typical Amazon.
Well, I'm just waiting for the moment where we can watch different players' Twitch streams, and they'll be in sort of imagine a cubicle, kind of like what we're in now, like a box room set that is completely populated and decorated with items from Amazon. And as a viewer, you can just go on, and while you're watching the stream, you can purchase the beer fridge, you can purchase the chair, you can purchase the glasses, you can purchase basically the entire set that the player is playing on. So I'm waiting for that to happen.
So actually, you might not be familiar, it's one of those underrepresented stories, but Twitch now has something called Twitch Extensions. And there are a lot of them, but one of them is really interesting, which basically says that a streamer can have kind of can have a list of like products they use in their stream, or so whether it is the actual game, so they can say I'm playing FIFA right now, or I'm playing Call of Duty. It can be the mic that they use, or whatever product they want to push. and it can pop up into the screen so that people can click on it and buy it. So it's already been there.
It's already happening.
But I like the fact that you were saying, and this is really, really good for streamers to know, it's like, integrate that not only in your stream, but integrate that in the actual physical environment that you're streaming from. Like, show them this these type of products.
Absolutely. I mean, your camera, you're only as good as your angles, right? I mean, as your camera is pointed on you, you should know as a streamer or as anyone who's on camera exactly what the audience is seeing, and having that sort of on-camera awareness, as I like to call it, knowing exactly what's going to be in frame, and maybe switch it up. Maybe every week you show something different. Maybe you have something different so that it will capture the attention, or it's something you can talk about. You know, you are, as a gamer, or streamer, you're basically responsible for creating your own environment. Mm-hmm. So it's up to you. And if it was me, I would monetize it as much as possible.
So talking about, you know, streaming and being in front of the camera, let's move on to our second half of our podcast. And let's talk about you. So I don't come across people as often who have as varied of a resume in any type of industry as you have. I mean, it's basically say, what part of the entertainment industry haven't you like hosted for, or haven't you been a part of? So for people who don't know who Julie Alexandra is, like, give us your background.
Oh my gosh. I've hosted everything from the news to entertainment news to sideline reporting for Major League Baseball and football to motocross to the Miss USA pageant, the Wendy Williams show, and everything in between. But really, I'm sure we can just talk about my esports background. I started with Major League Gaming back in 2008 when they were doing the Pro Tour, the Pro Circuit, as it was called, of Halo 3. And we had 4 to 5 events a year. And then I hosted an in-studio show with Chris Puckett called the Old Spice Report. And props to Old Spice and Dr. Pepper and Stride Gum for being early, early, early brand integrators and sponsors of esports, because they were there before anyone else. And Hot Pockets too. And so we hosted the Old Spice Report, and it was a weekly show where it was just a rundown of everything that was going on, the news of the day that was going on in esports. And it was way before its time. It was so much fun. I really had no idea what I was getting into. It was sort of my first foray into esports. I had played maybe a tiny bit of video games like right before, but I really had to learn on the job. But it was so much fun, and I ended up working for Major League Gaming for 4 years, doing sideline and hosting content for them between 2008 and 2011. And then I've come back a couple times to do some Call of Duty. I was just at the World Championships last year in Orlando, and so it's been amazing to see it grow. And I've also had a mainstream sports background as well.
Talk about that.
I also started in 2008. I worked for the New York Mets for 3 years, and then I was a VJ on MTV, and then I came back to sports, hosting college football programs for Big Ten Network, Sports Illustrated, and then also Fox, mainstream big sports. Fox for their Saturday night 8 p.m. game of the week. And I did that for a few years. And then I went back to baseball as the sideline reporter for the Washington Nationals, moved to D.C., and came back to New York, and then hosted 2 years on a syndicated entertainment show where we did a lot of red carpet and we covered a lot of the awards and we interviewed lots of celebrities from sports and entertainment. And then I moved out to San Diego to cover the Padres in San Diego. And all throughout that, I've done voiceovers and also worked in other sort of areas of gaming. And I was an ambassador for Xbox for many years, covering gaming events and E3 and conventions. So it kind of runs the gamut. I love it because I love to work, and I love entertainment. I love sports, and I love it when the two worlds cross over. And it's been amazing to see sort of the evolution of esports and to have been involved at the ground level. I mean, I can honestly say I am the only on-camera talent that has both mainstream sports and esports experience. And to be part of it from the beginning as the only, or first, I guess, female sideline reporter in esports back in 2008.
So, you know, you're extremely qualified to talk about this just because you have, as you just said, traditional sports and esports experience. So, So what can not only, you know, esports learn from traditional sports from a hosting perspective, but also let's flip it around. What can traditional sports learn from esports as well?
Well, I think esports has taken a lot from mainstream sports, because what I see when I watch a lot of the commentators is they're kind of doing their best impressions of a Joe Buck, yeah, or a Matt Vasgersian, or a Kevin Burkhart. So I think finding their own voice, I think some have a different style than others. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of the esports commentators have not been properly or traditionally media trained. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of just going off the cuff. And so you sort of get this very casual conversational tone when it comes to esports, which is great. And I think it works for the medium too. I mean, when you're streaming, I don't need an announcer voice, mm-hmm, as they say in voiceovers. I just need a casual conversation. You can just talk to me like I'm here in the room next to you. And so I like that about esports. And I like that it is a very sort of casual, off-the-cuff, non-traditional, unpolished, yes, delivery, which is really fun. I just have a problem sometimes when technically it's an unsound performance, because I think a lot of the casters, a lot of the, you know, on-air, quote-unquote, personalities could use a little media training, could use just a little bit of polish. I think there is space for that, but not to the point where it strips them of their personality and their what they bring to it, because so much of it is that. I mean, you look at the shoutcasters and they're having a full-on meltdown, you know, mm-hmm, in the booth, and it's great. And we live for that. We love that. I mean, it's like we have so many different varying Gus Johnsons in esports, mm-hmm, just having an Xavier meltdown. Mm-hmm. So it's great. It's awesome. But I think traditional sports, what they can take away from esports is also maybe to have a little fun with it, because there really are no guidelines in esports. Esports is kind of just finding its way when it comes to what they have on camera. I mean, and that also comes from the fact that I don't know that many of the producers really know what they want. Mm-hmm. And so it allows room for the casters to breathe a little bit and bring in their own personality to it. So I think on the traditional sports side, you know, maybe if they were given a little bit of the leeway, that would be kind of nice. But they could both learn from each other. But I really enjoy watching a lot of the casters. I mean, they know their stuff. And when they break down the footage, I think another challenge is to make it accessible. Especially now, we've got Overwatch League. And you've got some people tuning in who have never even seen gameplay, yes, before. They've never even seen it. So I think the onus is really on the casters, on the analysts, on the on-air talent for esports. It doesn't matter what game you're covering. But the onus is now, you have a much wider audience looking in. You've got traditional sports investors that are going to be watching these casts, are going to be watching these streams, and they may not know what these kills mean. They may not understand what's going on the map. So I think without dumbing it down too much for the, you know, for the serious fan, I think they need to open it up a little bit and make it a little more accessible and maybe explain things a little bit more thoroughly.
So I think you're touching on a lot of interesting points here. You mentioned the Overwatch League. You mentioned kind of looking for a hybrid between, on one end, being kind of a professional announcer, but on the other hand, not forgetting that the casters kind of, that's different from traditional sports host, is that you're also here to provide entertainment and not just, you know, analyze it, but also, you know, have fun. Like, just you, it's much more of, oh, you're being with your friends, you're watching a game, as opposed to you're watching, you know, the traditional sports host. And one of the things that I found very different is, I think for the past few months, for some reason, you know, I watch my soccer, but any other sports, traditional sports, I've shut down. So I watch my soccer every week, but then I watch probably 10 times as much of esports, just because I've lately have found that a lot more of an interesting part of my time, even when I don't fully understand the game. And I look back and I watched the Super Bowl like a few months ago, and I was like, what? This is so different. Like, this is not fun. So I do think that you're touching on something really interesting there. So looking back and just general like hosting in esports, like how has that progression been from like, you know, 2008 to 2011, and then lately you're doing some going back to Call of Duty. So what is kind of how have you seen the progression of hosts since then?
I think the production value has improved so much.
Yeah.
I mean, we were basically in convention center ballrooms, putting content out there, and now they've got a full-on studio with multi-cameras and a light grid above you and makeup artists. So I think the overall look is a lot more polished and a lot more professional. And I think by proxy, that just makes someone on camera elevate a little bit. It makes you sort of step up to the plate. I think that a lot of the casters, you know, you've got the OGs that are still there, that are still casting. You've got Fwizz and you've got MLG Puckett.
Well, he's at YouTube now. Right?
He's at YouTube, yeah. But for a while he was doing MLG events for Call of Duty. Mm-hmm. And but you see sort of the elevated delivery that those guys have been able to provide it. And then you also see a lot of the younger guys that are coming up that came up watching those guys. Mm-hmm. And so they're doing as much as they can to elevate their delivery. And I mean, I think it's fantastic just to see sort of everyone getting better. And I'm sure, you know, 3, 5, 10 years from now, we're going to look back on some of the first Overwatch League, you know, inaugural season, and they're going to say, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. Or I can't believe that one came out like that. And it's just going to get better.
So we've talked about kind of the growth as a host. So, but one of the areas where we have seen growth, where we can see more growth, is kind of the further engagement of women in esports. And once again, as kind of become kind of a cliche, you're very qualified to talk about this because you were a sideline reporter, a female sideline reporter, in a time where that wasn't a thing. So you had to open up a door for others in the future to feel more comfortable to do that or see that as a potential future. So, you know, how do you see the role of women in esports grow, and kind of what is some advice you can give to decision makers on how to make that process as good as possible?
Wow. Well, I think it's getting a lot better. It's becoming a lot more inclusive. I will say props to MLG for being inclusive from the beginning. I would say the staff behind the scenes that worked in the corporate office at Major League Gaming from 2008 to 2011 during my time there, I would say it was 60-40.
Wow.
Men to women. And they had a lot of women. They employed a lot of women. I know that it is an initiative with a lot of these publishers, a lot of these gaming companies, there is a big push to get women involved. And I love that. I also think there's a lot of fear on the part of a lot of these companies to put women in front of the camera because they're afraid that they are going to be up for a scrutiny that is 10 times as much as the male counterparts will experience. And they're not wrong.
Yes.
But at the same time, you can't just hide your women in your corporate cubicle. So you have to put them out there. You have to, you know, get the audience used to seeing a female presence, used to hearing a female voice. And, you know, we go through the same issues in mainstream sports. I mean, there are some guys that say, well, I don't need my game broken down by a female. I don't want to hear about snaps and punts from a girl. Well, okay, I'm probably not going to change his idea or his view. But I think we have this unique opportunity with esports, as it is an emerging market in sports, that if we solidify that we have a female presence in front of the camera now, it'll only be easier as we go on. And just because you have, I guess I want to say that, you know, a lot is expected of female on-camera talent in esports because the publishers and the gaming companies want them to already be ensconced in the community, already have a following with the community, already be streaming and gaming themselves, and they want them to talk about it, and they want them to construct interesting interviews and produce segments and be good hosts. Exactly. You can't always have it all. I mean, I love Pam Oliver, I don't know that she's ever snapped a football mm-hmm. on a field, and she probably hasn't. So to expect that your female talent needs to be ensconced in the community before even saying a word on camera, I think is a little bit unrealistic. But I think having the trust in someone who is media trained and knows what they're talking about on camera, who can provide compelling content, I think that's where the value is placed, because everything else can be learned. And I think gaining the trust of the players and being a professional, to me, is more compelling on camera than having someone who may be a quote unquote gamer, but cannot hold or control a panel, or cannot run a panel, or cannot really police a hosted show. That's a problem. That I don't think they should do. And I've seen a lot of those shows fail because they put a female in that position who maybe has no on-camera experience, but she's a quote unquote gamer, and it just doesn't work. So I think they have to pick and choose the roles. I was told by an executive that, oh, well, we're going to have a female sideline, but that's the easiest role to fill. And I thought, well, okay, I disagree. I don't think that they need to definitely, you know, certainly push a female into a role that she's not comfortable mm-hmm. in. But I do think it would be compelling if these brands would then hire female talent to cover in ways that, you know, went to their skills.
Yeah, and just to tie it back to our first story. So when you see people like Ninja and Drake, you know, you see Drake like being open about his love for Fortnite mm-hmm. and the mainstreamification of gaming, I think it all starts on the grassroots level. Like when more women are engaged, and to be quite frank, a lot of times in the past they were interested, but the community, they would be unicorns, and no one wants to be a unicorn, right? But mm-hmm. I think when I go to an esports event now, as opposed to 6-7 years ago, I see a lot more women being part of the community. And when you see that, then the logical next step is, okay, when they grow up, or just, you know, a few of them mm-hmm. will end up becoming not just sideline reporters, as you said, or being a host, but being analysts. Like, because you can have these amazing hosts who just happen to be female mm-hmm. and can be analysts. So I do think that we are making some steps there. I think your points of trying, of not looking for that unicorn, but like trying to, you know, just take someone who's qualified for a certain role and just give her that role
yeah.
because she's qualified is very, very, very true. But to kind of the outside world, because an outside world likes to see it black and white. And too often you see articles that say it's horrible, and then it isn't. It's a lot more gray, right? So I do think that we are an emerging industry, but we're a very young industry. And traditional sports took 50, 60, 70 years to get where it is now. And we are approaching that point of traditional sports in, you know, 15, 20 years. So I do think that 5-6 years from now, we'll see a different picture. But the only way we'll see a different picture is if I can speak to this as a man. If men men are making it a more accepting environment, I do think we're seeing that tide. So before we wrap up, I know there are a lot of listeners from a variety of aspects of the industry, and I do know that lately a lot of like younger people that are interested in the industry have started to listen, as opposed to just, you know, executives and people who are already in the space. So to people that are interested in the hosting part of esports, what are some advice you can give to them?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, go for it. I think now is the time to get into it. I mean, like you said, this industry is just beginning. And if you can get in the early stages, especially now where we're seeing it, you know, come together a little bit more, I think you should do it. I think make your own tape, do your own stand-ups, construct your own interviews, create your own content around gaming, and find your voice. Find what makes you unique, have a point of view, get specific. and be creative in the kind of gaming content you want to host or create. And I think it could almost be monetized if you want to, you know, make your own thing, or you could take it to a company and say, hey, this is the kind of show I want to do for you. What do you think? And I mean, that's what I did. I remember MLG gave me my own show. We called it Julie Show. And my whole sort of idea for it was that I wanted to interview the people behind gaming, the mm-hmm. people who made the game. I wanted to interview the artists. I wanted to interview the developers. I mean, I had Cliffy B on. I had a guy who basically his job was to construct weaponry in different mm-hmm. games. And that those sort of stories really fascinated me. I mean, this was Julie's show was way before its time.
Yeah, then. Yeah.
And but we had a cool little setup. We had a couch and we had a table. It was almost like, you know, a little talk show. And I would invite these guys in and I would do an interview with them. And I think you have to find out what interests you about the gaming community or about gaming itself in general or about competition and highlight that. And I think there is room there. I mean, you're going to see a whole new crop of on-camera talent, especially as TV contracts come up. I think that's a really interesting thing to see how that sort of transcends. And because we're going to see gaming, and we already are seeing gaming on TV, but you know, it's a very different style between on TV and streaming.
Great. So Julie, thank you so much for coming on the Esports Boom podcast. Where can people follow you or find you?
Well, thank you so much. You can follow me on Twitter at Julie Alexandria, JulieAlexandria. You can find me on Instagram at JulieAlexandria00. And you can find me on Facebook, just my name, Julie Alexandria.
We'll put the link to your Twitter in the description box. Thank you very much for listening, as well as the Esports Boom podcast, and we're looking